course, it's always a pleasure to be a part of this lectureship, and of course, it's been a pleasure for a good number of years being a member of the congregation here. And while we'll want to be talking about chapters 46 and 47, I want to talk about some other things that hopefully relate to it in some respects, realizing that what we see at times might be a bit different than the way it'll show up within the scriptures. And with that, I go back to the time when Jacob managed to acquire the blessings that should have gone to Esau. We just think of how that was handled and how it came out that Jacob got the blessings instead of Esau. And certainly we're not going to quarrel with regard to it, and yet at the same time, if that were an issue that came before me, the decision would have been entirely different. And that's because I would be asking, in fact, would probably label it as being identity theft. And it might not only be a criminal action, but also possibly a civil action. And you'd be inquiring as to, with regard to the actual blessing that was given, and Isaac would have spelled out exactly what was the blessing. You'd be asking as to who it was intended for. You'd be asking as to how the individual came that was seeking the blessing, whether you'd be able to have identified, that is to see that individual, to know. And of course, you'd be getting that information as to the effort to determine who it was by feeling and by the smell. The only distinction being otherwise with regard to the fact that the voice sounded like that of Jacob and not of Esau. You might very well also call in the mother, and by the time you got through hearing all of it, I don't think there'd be any question in your mind, but that it was a put-up type situation to steal the blessings from Esau and give it unto Jacob. In any event, what we are seeing unfolding here, and it's been touched on to some degree by many of the speakers, but I want to perhaps be repeating a bit of it in a way, but we're seeing unfolding over a good number of years both that which is physical and also that which is spiritual. From a physical standpoint, we're seeing the unfolding of God's great plan with respect to bringing about the nation of the children of Israel. And we can see this unfolding as the children of Israel are going to end up in Egypt. But what about Joseph? Did he have any inkling with regard to any of this? And that's very difficult to say in some respects. But certainly when he begins to have those dreams, and being able to tell his brothers and his father with regard to the time coming when they're going to bow down to him, this must have given him at least some kind of an indication, if he believed those dreams, that something lay ahead, whatever it might possibly be. And then when we see the situations that occurred when he ended up in the household of Potiphar, and when Potiphar's wife sought to induce him into a sexual relationship, and part of what he indicated was not only this would be in conflict with that of his relationship with Potiphar, but also it would be offensive unto God. But in conjunction with this, what we continue to see is that wherever he is, that effort is being blessed. And others were recognizing it, and I wonder whether Joseph also was taking note with regard to it. No doubt he was doing the best that he could, but even under the worst of circumstances, God was blessing where he was. The same thing occurred when he was then put into jail as a result of the wrongful accusations that were made by Potiphar's wife. And his action there resulted in him being given very special treatment by those in charge of the jail. And when the two individuals came from Pharaoh's household, such as the butler and the baker, and when they had their dreams, Joseph being able to interpret the dreams recognized and indicated that it was that which came from God. We've had mention with regard to how it was that it was some 2 years that passed before the butler made mention with regard to Joseph being able to interpret the dreams. But surely this was part of God's plan, because what we recognize is that it wasn't necessarily even pertinent until the time that God saw fit to give the dreams to Pharaoh. And then the butler remembered and mentioned Joseph, and Joseph was brought out of prison. What we're seeing over and over again is a carrying out of no more than an unfolding of God's plan with regard to the children of Israel. And as has been mentioned with respect to his encounter with his brothers, the indication once again is that as they're terrified, that he tells them not only at this point, but at a later point also, that this was all God's. This was God's doing. We're unfolding what God had planned. When you get down to the very end of the book of Genesis, and I recognize I'm getting into somebody else's territory here, but we're at the point where Joseph is now dying. And what is it that he has to say? Very last chapter, and begin with verse 24, "And Joseph said unto his brethren, I die, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land unto the land which he sware to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones from hence." Many years previously, in the time of Abraham, God had indeed spoken with regard to that which was to come to pass. Back in the 15th chapter of the book of Genesis, where God said unto Abram, verse 13, "Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years, and also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance." That's pretty clear. What's Joseph saying? What's happening is no more than what Abraham had said, had God had said to Abraham, Isaac, all previously, and it's now being unfolded, and that time is going to come when you're going to be leaving, and I'm simply asking that you take my bones with you when you go. He is no more than that of carrying out the will of God. He is a token being used by God to carry out his will. Well, you might say it's the providence of God that is being played out in the use of individuals. And I've done it a number of times, and I'm going to make some mention with regard to it now. And I'm hoping I'm not carrying it too far, and certainly not for any praise for myself with respect to it, but rather to give thought as to how much providence of God can play, or at least to raise the question of whether the providence of God has been involved in your life. And I'd ask you to think with regard to that yourself. I happen to have grown up in obviously a good number of years ago, and my father had a government job that moved us around, about like being in the military. But in any event, in the junior high, 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, for whatever reason, they gave us a test in the 7th grade, and if you passed it, you skipped half of the 8th grade. Good, most of us passed it. Then, at a later point, they said, okay, those who passed, you skipped half of the next grade. So, in other words, you got through the 7th, 8th, and 9th in 2 years rather than three. That make any difference? Wouldn't seem to. Other than the fact that I ended up then graduating from high school at age 16, in 1946. World War II, as far as the fighting was concerned, had ended in 45. Our government did not declare the war over until the end of December of 46. I don't know why, but another fellow and myself, friends, decided on my birthday, 17th birthday, which made me eligible with my parents' permit to go down and enlist in the service. And I'm sure we didn't give any thought with regard to the overall effect of it. What was the benefit I got of it? All of World War II GI Bill benefits. I couldn't have gone to college afforded otherwise. I had a 3-year enlistment. Part of what the government taught me to do was to type, which has been a benefit down through the rest of my years. Where did I spend those 3 years or most of it? In Hawaii. Can you imagine a 17, 18, 19-year-old in a good job and working about 6 hours a day in Hawaii? Wasn't bad at all. But in trying to follow more in going to college, mind you, I grew up as a member of the church. My parents were members of the church. We attended regularly wherever we happened to be living. But I had the opportunity to speak, being the preacher, at two small congregations, about 6 months at each one. That was about all the experience I really had at preaching. I decided that probably in the last year that I would go into law school and thought about the University of Texas, but SMU offered me a scholarship for the first year, so I went there. But in the second semester of that first year, a fellow that I had known, a member of the church, it would work a little bit together, neither one of us otherwise done any preach or anything, he was preaching at a small congregation outside of Dallas, and he was going to be leaving. Somehow or other recommended me. I went out and tried out. With no more experience than that, they took me on as their preacher, knowing I was going to school on a full-time basis. It was a nice congregation. Being a country congregation, it's probably 7,500 people. Preacher's house that the wife and I could live in, getting a decent salary. And even during the summer of the second year of law school, we expected to be working in a legal office, and I was put to work in the U.S. Attorney's Office there in Dallas. So here again, preaching full-time, working full-time, otherwise, but God taking care of me. Anything further? I wanted to practice law. I wanted to preach. I decided, because of how great the military had been, maybe I could preach. Uncle Sam pay my salary, and all would be well. So I went into the service again as a first lieutenant. And what was the first assignment? The Air Force Academy, which was just being built. The first class had just come down there from base up in Denver. So they could graduate in the spring. My wife and I and Michael arrived in early September. A congregation not too long afterwards was starting in that area, and I got to preach for them for at least a year until they could afford a full-time preacher. And then after a bit more time, one of the larger, older congregations, their preacher had left. They were going to be looking for a preacher. I got to be their preacher and was there for a year or longer until I got orders to go to England. When I got to England, there was a military congregation that met just off the base. I preached for that congregation for some 3 years. And so it went from one assignment to the other. Uncle Sam was paying my way. He even sent me back to college, to University of Texas, for another degree, and he paid for all of that, and I got a salary while I did nothing but go to school. Served as an elder at some 5 different congregations, including Randolph. Having several other assignments after leaving this area, ultimately would come back. And it came about in a very unusual way, but in any event was brought back to this area. Knew a lot of the people because of having been here before. this congregation was just beginning to start, and the group of people at that time were meeting in a break room across the street in one of the businesses. I started preaching for them, and of course we first acquired this building that's the fellowship building located, and we had it located in another place. It's the top half of a barracks building, and then subsequently, of course, we moved it over to here and built this building. So for about 20 years, I was able to serve as the preacher here. And then, of course, to work in other areas after retiring from the military. And not for any blessings of mine, but Uncle Sam and, above all else, God had taken care of me throughout this, and I didn't need a salary. And that's no blessing to me, because God was taking care of me throughout this entire time. I couldn't have planned any of this, any of these moves. I had nothing to do with it. God, I like to think, was the one who took a hand with regard to it. I mentioned that because when I look at what is unfolding here, I see nothing but the hand of God in it from the very beginning to the end. And as I remind others, it might not hurt to look from time to time ourselves and ask ourselves, how much has God played a part with regard to our lives and making use of it? And it's only when we look back that we perhaps get a glimpse with regard to how much God has done. I can't take a bit of credit for anything. Whatever I've done, if it has been worthwhile, it has all been at the hand of God. Now, what was unfolded that I made mention of earlier was all of a physical nature. What about the spiritual side? Well, even as was indicated by Joseph, the time was going to come when they would be leaving the country, and he wanted them to take his bones with them. And we know that that's exactly what happened. After they had been there for some years, they indeed, God took them out after all the plagues, Moses coming and the plagues that were there, and they left, crossing the Red Sea and the army of Pharaoh, the Egyptian army, being destroyed, and they're now liberated. Does that have any particular significance whatsoever? I think that it does. From a spiritual nature, and you probably are already well ahead of me and remember just exactly where I'm going to be turning. I want to go over to the 10th chapter of the book of 1 Corinthians. And there, notice this particular statement. Moreover, brethren, I would not that ye should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea and were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank that spiritual rock of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. What was the status of the children of Israel at the time when that liberation was coming about? They're in slavery. What is going to happen? They're going to cross over the Red Sea. God's going to prepare that. They're going to cross over it on dry land. And once they're on the other side, and the army of the Egyptians is going to be following them, and they're going to be destroyed as the water closes back up. What's the status now of the children of Israel? They have been liberated physically from slavery. What's the spiritual lesson? I think we understand it and have known it all along. It's very, very pictorial with regard to individuals being in slavery, in bondage to sin, and how that as a result of being baptized into Christ, that we are then liberated from that sin. But what we recognize is that it wasn't all that long, and they were beginning to deviate from what God was commanding, and on several occasions, they were wanting to rebel and say, let's just go back to Egypt. And oftentimes, is that exactly what happens to individuals who become Christians, And at some point, they're wanting to say, you know, I enjoyed what I was doing before, or they in some way are enticed to go back to it, and so they do. And that's part of what you're learning when you get over into the third and fourth chapter of the book of Hebrews, where he there points out with regard to the children of Israel and how many of them did not enter into the promised land, and why? Because of unbelief. There was every evidence with regard to God's existence and his blessings that he had given to them, the freedom he had provided. And what's the lesson? He goes on in the chapter 4 to point out that we need to be careful lest we be of the same nature. And you get something of the same picture with regard to what I'm talking about there in the 6th chapter of the book of Romans, after talking about that which we recognize as baptism, and that's what he's speaking of there. But what he goes on to say later on is in verse 16, "Know ye not that to whom ye yield yourselves servants to obey, his servants ye are to whom ye obey, whether of sin unto death or of obedience unto righteousness." You're getting that same lesson over and over again. And so it is that we have a lot that's really being contained within the material that we are looking at, and we don't want to get, you know, just looking at it verse by verse, necessarily overlooking a tremendous lesson that is there. But having said all of that, and hopefully not wasting way too much time, I want to get back over into the book of Genesis, and there to the assigned chapters of chapters 46, 47. Here we are that they are now, Jacob and his family are in Beersheba. They have come down from some distance. They have been in several other cities that have been mentioned, and now they are in Beersheba. And God is telling Israel, Jacob, that they should go on down into Egypt, and that God would make of them a great nation. And so it is that God will continue to be with them, and he even points out that Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. And that may be no more than an indication you're going to be there long enough until Joseph is able to put on your eye, his hand on your eyes as you have died, and thus closing your eyes by his hand. And so it is that all those wagons that had been brought in, that was of clear evidence that Joseph was still alive, that they have loaded up and they've proceeded. And as you continue to look at that chapter, a good bit of it relates to listing those who were accompanying him. Here we get a number, something in the neighborhood of some 70, as verse 27 makes mention of those that came, which came into Egypt, were 70. You'll find the same number being mentioned over in the first chapter of the book of Exodus. When Stephen speaks with regard to this account, he makes the number slightly larger. But in any event, I think we would recognize that indeed there would have been more, and some of this has already been mentioned in previous lectures. For example, when Jacob and the household were traveling and going back home and knew that they were going to meeting up with Esau and his 400, and how that Jacob divided up the family into two groups, one mention is made with regard to servants. Clearly, servants were part of the group. Mention has also been made with regard to the community, that two of the sons particularly ended up in killing all of the men. Mention is made that the children and women or wives were taken captive. How many? We don't know. The only thing is, clearly there would have been a larger number than just this basic one, but this is not unusual, as God oftentimes just centers on those that are considered primary concern. In any event, they've now proceeded on towards Egypt, probably traveling in the neighborhood of some 200 miles. You can imagine all the difficulty in moving and needing to stop every night, and feeding of the flock, and the caring for the people. This had to be some real journey, even with the best of provisions that had been made for them. Joseph has now made ready his chariot, and went up to meet his father there in Goshen. And he might even raise, and then we don't have an answer for it. Many of the other things that come up that we don't have an answer for. Joseph has been number two man within the kingdom, just the next man under Pharaoh, for 7 years of the good times, plenty, and now with the famine. There is no mention of him ever reaching out to find his family of where they were or how they were doing. It is only when those brothers begin to show up that we have any indication of contact. And that's during the time when the famine is already in existence. In any event, what we see here is a very beautiful reunion. And something else, it may still be true over in that part of the world, but we see a lot more emotion that's being reflected in the Old Testament and even in the New than we often see. Because when they would meet in circumstances like this, and I have no doubt that it was a true feeling as they are reflecting here, and we are told that he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while, and Israel said unto Joseph, now let me die, since I have seen thy face, because thou art alive. Certainly a very significant meeting. And if we had been there, we might even sort of want to turn our heads away because of just how emotional it might have been. Problem is, while they showed their emotions often in love and in matters of this nature, it also seems to have shown in times of anger, just as we've already noticed in some instances, and they weren't hesitant to reach out and to kill others when we might think that highly inappropriate. Now, Joseph takes time to prepare them for meeting Pharaoh. And that would not be unusual in this day and time. If you have a meeting that you're going to be setting up, and you're one that's in the number two position, for example, and you're going to have those that you're going to bring in and to introduce, you may want to prepare them for it. And especially when their background is completely different. Their mode of dress, everything is completely different. And you might remember that when the brothers were showing up and the indication was that the Egyptians, it was an abomination to them to eat with the Israelites. They apparently wanted no part. So it was very pertinent to provide them information as to how to conduct themselves and what to expect when they went before Pharaoh. And you notice part of that. And he indicated that, Joseph said unto his brethren, unto his father's house, I will go up and show Pharaoh and say unto him, my brethren and my father's house, which were in the land of Canaan, are come unto me. And the men are shepherds, for their trade hath been to feed cattle. And they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. And it shall come to pass when Pharaoh shall call you and shall say, what is your occupation, that ye shall say, thy servant's trade hath been about cattle from our youth even till now, both we and also our fathers, for ye may dwell in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is an abomination unto the Egyptians. Getting some instructions. And what we would recognize, and even during the time of Moses, Pharaoh had said at one time, you just have your stay here and hold your sacrifices here. And Moses said, no, we can't do that because the Egyptians will stone us. It's not going to be appropriate. Now, what's the difference, really, between the shepherds and the cattle? Well, I think basically it comes down, if we're talking about the shepherd, we're looking after sheep. If you're talking about cattle, you're taking in the whole range, whether you're talking about camels or oxen or including sheep or any of the animals. But what happens is that when they come in chapter 47, and Joseph first speaks to Pharaoh, you can see this is a very formal type of meeting. no different than we might expect today, where you are meeting with some individual of great importance who is obviously a very busy person, and so you're going to have it very structured. Joseph comes in and says, "My father and my brethren, their flocks, their herds, they're all here." He takes five of the men and presents to Pharaoh. Not all of them, only five. We aren't told why. I would say that the good reason would be, again, because of the formal nature of this. You don't need a whole bunch. What you may want are those that you think are going to make the best appearance, be able to best respond to anything that takes place, and they are representative of the total brothers. They come in, and indeed Pharaoh asks the very question that Joseph said, "What is your occupation?" Well, they say, "Thy servants are shepherds, both we and also our father." And it seems to be a little bit different than what Joseph had instructed, but no doubt that's basically what they were. So Pharaoh does not seem to take any offense with regard to this, and he in fact indicated that if thou knowest of any men of activity among them, then make them rulers over my cattle. So he's treating them very nice and broadening out the possible responsibilities. It's then when Jacob is brought forward, it almost gives the impression that he may have been outside and now brought in. It may be that he was just sort of stepped back out of the way, but in any event, he apparently was not the first one to be introduced, first those five brothers, and now Jacob. You notice this is very brief, very formal-like. Pharaoh is basically asking, "How old are you?" He gives a response, "Days of years of my pilgrimage, 130 years, few and evil have been the days of my life. They've not attained to the years and days of my fathers and their pilgrimage." Jacob then blesses Pharaoh and leaves the room. Again, if you looked at a very formal meeting today, well, some of you like me have been in those. You can well appreciate just how something of that nature. You've taken care of that formality. It has now been ended. And they, of course, are settled in the best of the land. And we're told that Joseph nourished his father and his brethren and all his father's household with bread according to their families. That's chapter 47, verse 12. Now, we're in the time of the famine. Joseph is taking care of his family. They're living in a separate area from the Egyptians. They're being extremely well taken care of. But mind you, these are the same people that the Egyptians would not want to eat with. Now, what we find is there's no bread in the land. So the people are coming and they're buying their food. And ultimately, they've run out of money. Next thing they say, and Joseph, in fact, tells them, "Give your cattle, and I'll give you the food for your cattle." And I don't know, but I can't help but imagine that a lot of that food that had been stocked up over those good years of plenty are also going to have to be used to feed the cattle. I don't think they're going to let them just starve to death after acquiring them in this manner. That runs out. And now, the people are coming, and they're saying, "You know, you've got all of our money, you've got all of our cattle, there's not anything left except our lives and our land." And so the indication is that basically their land becomes that of Pharaoh, and they belong to him. So Joseph has bought all the land for Pharaoh, and every man in his field thus mentions. And many of the people, I say maybe not all of them, but at least we get in verse 21 that as for the people, he removed them to cities from one end of the borders of Egypt, even unto the other end thereof. Now, part of what had also been indicated and the issue had raised with regard to providing seed so that plants could eventually be cultivated. And so that's what is ultimately going to occur. But you can see the status of everything because it has reached the point where all of these people, except for the priests, are basically owned by Pharaoh. The cattle, the land, everything. So this is sort of the way that it is, and can't help but wonder about Joseph and his treating of the priests, because they received special treatment. But those were the priests of Pharaoh, and he no doubt had control over them. But it also raises the question with respect to this as to what would become of the attitude of the Egyptians towards the people of Israel. Mind you, they've already been given the best of the land. They have already been provided the best of the food. There is no indication they have paid for anything, at least it's not mentioned as such. How would you feel about them? I don't think I'd think very highly of them. So when the time comes that we'll later find that there's another Pharaoh that knew not Joseph, it's very easy for them to be turned into slaves. But in the process, though as hard as it may seem, it keeps them as a separate people that God will allow to grow till it becomes a nation of people, and he, under his own time and manner, will remove them. And we finally conclude with Jacob as he is near dying, calls for Joseph. And he asks Joseph to swear that his burying place will be outside of Egypt, taking him back, you might say, to his home area. And so it is, it's going to conclude, and I think it's only natural he would have called to Joseph to speak because of the position that Joseph held as compared to the other brothers. And so we conclude the 46th and 47th chapters of the book of Genesis. Thank you very much.